here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of in-person therapy sessions are now happening online because of the coronavirus pandemic. Two Wisconsin therapists joined the show to tell us how it's working out. First, a couple of new surveys show that Americans don't think too highly of the news media in general. According to a survey from Axios, the media has lost the most approval of any industry during the COVID-19 pandemic, with the exception of airlines. Shortly after that poll came out, Gallup found that 86% of Americans say news outlets show some or a lot of bias in their reporting. That's been on the rise since the late 1990s. They also find that most people think other people are really likely to see biased news. At the same time, a big majority of respondents say that the media is important to a functioning democracy. Our next guest says the findings underscore the importance of local journalism. Penelope Muse Abernathy is the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina and a former executive at the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. She's the author of the book Saving Community Journalism, The Path to Profitability, and the forthcoming report News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive? Benny, good to have you back with us.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's good to be here, and thank you for discussing this very important topic.
Yeah, before we dig into the local level, big picture, what do you think? We see surveys like these from time to time, this declining public trust in the media. What do you make of results like these?
Well, I think the good news is that we still see a vast majority of people in this country believe that a free press and an active press is very important to this democracy. And I mean, the studies have shown that when we lose trust in our democratic institutions, of which a free press is one of those, and especially news organizations, then democracy is at risk in many ways.
What do you think drives the decline in trust to the news media? There's a lot going on. People might think of different things when they think of the media, but what do you see behind these numbers overall in declining trust?
Well, I think there are two things. One, I think there is the increasing polarization in this country that has been driven in large part by our national media. It started in the late 90s, as you 1990s, as you point out, and has continued apace over the last 20 years. It's a reflection in many ways, and we see it in the data that Gallup and Knight showed most recently in this 2020 report. It depends on whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent, and how you view media and whether you find them distrustful or biased in that regard, depending on your party affiliation. So one thing is polarization in this country, driven, in fact, by cable networks in to a large degree that come out with a partisan view on many subjects. The second thing that is really driving it is one thing that percolates under the surface is the loss of local news. 90% of what circulates on our social media now, much more than 90%, most of what we have access to on a daily basis has to do with political stances that we really ultimately as citizens have nothing to do with the outcome. What we need to be concerned about is what are the major decisions we need to make on a local level that affect the quality of our lives. And because we've lost so many newspapers, which are often the prime, if not the sole source for people living in local and mid-sized communities, that leaves us with no option to find out any of that information. So instead, what we get is a steady diet of national politics, which increases the polarization.
I've seen some people make the case that because we have so little local news, just on a very practical level, it's less likely that anybody knows a reporter personally or has seen a reporter cover an event that they were at personally in their community. That creates a distance, if it's, you know, so nationally weighted in the media, between the consumers and the producers of media. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there are two things that have been driving that, too. One is the economics have actually put many newspapers out of business. We've lost a fourth of our newspapers over the last 15 years. Most of those were in very small and mid-sized communities, whether that was in a inner city neighborhood, whether it was a suburb, or whether it was rural areas. But the second thing is, at the same time, because the newspaper industry is suffering so much, we have had an increasing consolidation in the business. So the average chain right now is in the much of the top 10 chains average about 80 to 90 newspapers in one chain. The largest chain in the country, Gannett, which was formed by the merger of Gannett and Gatehouse, has 600 newspapers in that chain. There's just a loss of the to the community where the newspaper is located when you have large chains coupled with the notion that you also have many fewer newspapers that have been consolidated or merged or closed.
Media amidst in local media outlets, especially newspapers. Penelope Muse Abernathy is with us from the University of North Carolina. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 as we talk about a decline in trust in the media with Penelope Muse Abernathy. What do you think? 800-642-1234. And do you want to see more local media? Let's go to a caller now. Joe is with us in Jefferson. Joe, hi.
Hi, this is a great topic. There used to be a gentleman on this station years ago in the 90s that talked about media every Friday. His name was Dave Beekman, I believe. But it's such a great topic to talk about the media itself. And I think my question was the difference between left-wing bias and right-wing bias. I mean, everybody thinks their side is maybe not biased, but I think left-wing bias manifests in the way of what they don't tell you, where in right-wing bias we see almost bordering on conspiracy to just misinformation, exaggeration, what you see on Fox News. So I wish the guests could maybe comment on the bias we see on the left, which is kind of what they just don't tell you. And it's not as harmful, in my opinion. Some call it lies of omission, but it's definitely a bias. So maybe she can talk about the two differences there.
Interesting. Joe, thanks for the call. What do you think? Bias by omission versus commission, Penelope?
Well, I think that there are two points on the recent survey that kind of point to an answer of some sort for the caller just now. One is that whole notion that when you ask whether the media needed to have more diversity, Democrats, which you would say were more left-leaning than Republicans, tended to answer, yes, we need more diversity to reflect more diversity in our reporting. And they were talking specifically about racial and ethnic diversity. When you talk to Republicans, they said, yes, we need more diversity. But what they pointed to was more of a diversity of viewpoints than what they were currently getting. So in many ways, that speaks to the notion that on the left, it is more of one of omission, where on the right, it's one more talking about certain types of information that supports an argument going forward. So I think that there is there's also a notion, too, that what the good news is 85% of the people who were polled felt that media organizations could do a lot to address some of the issues that we're talking about in terms of bias. And it strikes me that what came through repeatedly were things like everything from covering different viewpoints to hiring people from a variety of backgrounds to having media organizations bring people together in some kind of, I guess, post-COVID in-person gathering that brought people together to talk about the various viewpoints. I think what's not in there is also that there's kind of a lack, if I'm a normal news consumer, there's kind of a lack of transparency. I don't know how the reporter went about writing the story, what sources they used. And I think the more transparent news organizations can be, the more that trust will go up.
Yeah, I've seen, thanks for that call, Joe. I've seen some outlets actually have kind of a sidebar kind of about the making of the story. Here's who we called. Here's who we tried to call. It, just some of the nuts and bolts that went into how they reported it. Do you hope to see more of that?
Well, I think that has been a goal of quite a few journalists for at least the last couple of decades. I think that too often the way the cake was mixed was somehow not readily apparent to the folks that ended up consuming the cake. So I think the more we can be honest about what we went through to get the story, the better. I got a call, for example, earlier today for a reporter who's working on a paper that recently closed. And I started asking a whole range of questions about who they had talked to, who they hadn't talked to, because it helps me know even how to respond when I get called to make comments on that. And I think that one of the things that has suffered, I think, in this, as we've lost journalists, we've lost more than half of all newspaper journalists over the last decade alone, is that time is such an essence. We not only don't have time to touch all the bases as we did in the past, but we often don't have time to explain that we did.
We are talking about Americans' distrust of the news media, but faith in the need for news media with Penelope Muse Abernathy, Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you generally trust the media or some parts of it, or do you worry that there's too much bias or advocacy for particular political viewpoints? And do you think there's enough local news? Do you see enough coverage at a local level of what's going on, maybe in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're talking about America's relative distrust of the press. A recent poll by Gallup found that 86% of Americans say news outlets show at least some bias in their reporting. Penelope Muse Abernathy is with us from the University of North Carolina, author of Saving Community Journalism and News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have worries about bias in the news outlets you read or watch or listen to? Or bias in the ones that other people read, watch, or listen to? Do you feel like we have enough local coverage of issues? Does that make the news less useful to you if there's not good, solid local reporting? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have committed reporting in my misspent younger days, and I've also written and conducted surveys, and the right now we're looking at polling data about people's mistrust, and I realize that there are some questions like, do you think the media is biased, that everybody will answer yes. Nobody wants to say no, and I think if you think about it yourselves that you would realize that's true of yourselves. And ironically, of course, a lot of folks who respond that way have heard that same opinion from the media. So I just think that sometimes the answers are a little more cavalier, a little less profound than we should really get bent out of shape about.
Interesting. So it sounds like Penelope, a media bias toward and a public bias toward thinking that the media is biased, that the surveys might be misleading, he says. What do you think?
Well, I think he raised a couple of interesting observations. One is, what do we mean when we say media? Right. I mean, I prefer to say our news organizations are is a specific news organization biased. And what do we also mean in terms of bias? I do think there's a proclivity to always identify with a news organization that you consider biased, and to answer yes in some degree. But I'm also perturbed, too, because I think when we use the term media, we often conflate entertainment in with the news. So, what is an entertainment show, or what is largely a cable a news outlet, which makes no pretension about being unbiased. In fact, waves the partisan flag as much as it could, versus a news organization that's closer to home, a state or metro paper or a regional television station. I think that there is a notion that we lump everything in there together. And if we find several guilty parties, we then tend to assume that bias is rampant on that. I think the second thing, though, in polling that's really interesting is, yes, you can have questions that have a tendency to make people answer a certain way. I think what's important is to notice the trend over time. And I think what is most concerning to me as a journalist, as a former media executive, and now as a professor who believes very fervently that we need to have journalism that's very relevant for us in the 21st century and the digital age. What's concerning to me are the trends over time, and we've seen a distrust in media growing, as you mentioned, since the 1990s. So that, to me, is an alarming and concerning sign.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Terry with us in Green Bay. Terry, hello.
Hi, yeah, great topic here. You know, a big thing that I believe in, I used to work in radio myself, is and particularly a lot of conservative talk radio stations. The narrative is being driven over the past decades now of this lamestream media. The media lies to you. The mainstream media is always lying, lying, lying. And this narrative has been pushed by a lot of conservative right-wing talk show hosts, Fox News, TV, and a lot of other channels that the media lies all the time. And that's the narrative that's been pushed over the years. So I think that's where a bulk of this is. But at the same time, the media also does it, you know, the press also does it to themselves with how they cover things, and always that it's always political. So it's always this way or that way. And we hear the two pundits go at it when we actually never really dig into the facts of things or really do some deep diving. We just kind of say, here's the left perspective, here's the right perspective, and that's the story.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting points there, Penelope. First of all, the I guess kind of working the ref theory of the distrust being driven by, as Terry says, conservative talk outlets.
Well, I mean, the origin of Fox News in the 1990s was seen as a counterpoint to the major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and to a degree CNN. And so it is a narrative that Fox has stayed with in terms of being fair and balanced, with the notion that the others weren't fair and balanced. So there's a corollary to that. I think that is also one of those things too, that if you're, again, getting back to the loss of local news, I think it is, if you don't have a reporter covering your town council meetings, you don't have someone covering the school board, or if you don't know the reporter who rarely shows up there, there's something that was very central to this country and its expansion over the last 200 years, is that whole notion of a geographic identity. So geographic identity is still very important to us, especially on a national political level. And if you don't have someone kind of taking apart the issues at home, which really don't fall down along national partisan lines, and telling you how to live a better life, then everything gets caught up in this kind of partisan notion and your over-reliance on national news, because that's basically if you are a news consumer, that's the primary news you're consuming right now.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Penelope Muse Abernathy from the University of North Carolina, looking at public trust and distrust of the media and a decline in local media. Let's spend our last couple minutes on local news, Penelope. I think of, you know, one of the biggest stories in the national news over the last couple of years, the Jeffrey Epstein story, came about because of exactly one local reporter, not a small town reporter, but at the Miami Herald. How many stories do we miss if we have communities with, you know, only one or two reporters, period, or no reporters?
Well, I think the bigger, it's almost impossible to quantify. What we do know is, because of subsequent research that has been done at other institutions that have tracked basically both the quantity and the quality of local news, we know the quantity has been going down over the last 15 years as we've lost newspapers. So when you lose a newspaper, you lose the person who shows up at the school board meeting or the planning board meeting. When you lose a reporter off a state or regional newspaper like the Miami Herald, which broke the story, you lose the reporters that typically showed us how we were related to other people because of the trends that were occurring in the region, or had the time, and I want to emphasize the expertise, to basically go after a story like Jeffrey Epstein, spend time on it, and come together with a story that makes national headlines. So when we lose at the local level, it is kind of a boomeranging effect that goes all the way up to our national outlets. So I think what we need to look at is, what are the state and regional stories we've lost that would have become national headlines, as well as what are the local stories that could have influenced state and local policies that have not been covered. So I think I can't put a number on it right now, but I would say that you could assume if we've lost half of our reporters that there are probably at least that many over the past decade, there are at least that many stories that were not covered that could have should have been.
In just our last minute, we'll give you more time, I think, and we'll bring you back to talk about your new book when it comes out on news deserts. But in our last minute, is there a viable economic model to bring back that kind of local news coverage?
It depends on the community you're in. If we found that if you're in a community that has an average to above average economic growth and population projections and have a local owner or publisher who has some deal of local autonomy, then that person has at least a good shot of crafting a either a for-profit, nonprofit, or some kind of a hybrid model that will sustain local news. It will not be at the profit margins probably that we saw in the late 20th century, but there is an option. Where I am most concerned are on those economically struggling and marginalized communities that have literally lost their sole source of local news and information because that and lack digital access to an all digital format. So, I mean, I think it is a problem for our democracy. I think it is and one that is ripe for creative solutions.
Penny, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Penelope Muse Abernathy is the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina. She's the author of the book Saving Community Journalism, The Path to Profitability, and the forthcoming report, News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive? Talk to her about new surveys showing that Americans' distrust of the news media has been going up over the years. Coming up after the news, many therapists have had to take their work online. We'll hear about the challenges and opportunities in teletherapy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the details of WPR's partnership with the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative. First, since the coronavirus pandemic reached the U.S., more people have needed to rely on virtual technology for a lot of activities, work, personal connections, and therapy. According to the American Psychological Association, 3/4 of clinicians are conducting all their therapy appointments remotely. 2 Wisconsin therapists joined us last month for a look at the challenges and benefits of remote therapy or teletherapy. Rachel Zentner is a licensed professional counselor at Behavioral Health Clinic in Wausau. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Susan McDonald Conroy is a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist at Clarity Therapy Center in Onalaska. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob and Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Well, Rachel, let's start with you. How much teletherapy had you done before the pandemic, or was this a brand new thing for you?
This was not a brand new thing for me. I would say that probably only 10% of my practice was online prior to the COVID-19 pandemic hitting. So it was really limited. Maybe 1 to 2 clients per month were online at that time.
And have you had to make the switch to complete teletherapy, or at least for the first few months there?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We went to fully online for probably March through May. We started a limited opening of our clinic for high-level need and particular types of therapies that needed to be in person. And also just definitely at the clinician's discretion. I would say at this point, probably 75% of my practice is still online.
And Susan, what's your before and after when it comes to teletherapy?
Yeah, I had probably less experience than Rachel. I did have everything, all the systems and a HIPAA-compliant platform in place, but used it only in cases of bad weather or when someone somewhere else in the state was looking for a sex therapist or something that they couldn't find in their area. So not a lot prior. And then as the pandemic unfolded, there was lots of talks with clients about this might be how it goes. Let's do some informed consent forms and documentation. And it was a pretty quick switch to all but two of my clients. And two of my clients I continue to see in person.
Now, Rachel, I think a lot of the expectation was, okay, you know, this is just going to be second rate. It's not going to work as well as in person. What have you found switching to a lot more teletherapy than you had done previously?
I think that's a really good point, Rob. And I think that was maybe the assumption for both the clients and for the clinicians. I was really hesitant that I might lose a lot of body language or that energy exchange between a therapist and a client through online therapy. I've been pleasantly surprised in that I get a lot of great interactions when working with people over, very much like Susan said, the HIPAA-compliant platforms have wonderful technology in terms of what I can see with people, how I can observe people. The technology has been wonderful. And I think, at least from my perspective, both the client side of things and for myself as a clinician, reports have been overwhelmingly positive.
And Susan, what have you found maybe after the initial learning curve?
I think for the clients, initial learning curve as well, some of them were reluctant, like, okay, well, we'll see how it goes. And then some of the comments that I've heard is, wow, this is a lot better than driving in. You know, when you have clients that are driving maybe an hour to see you, all of a sudden it becomes way more convenient for them.
We're talking to Susan McDonald-Conroy and Rachel Zentner. They're both therapists here in Wisconsin. They're telling us about their experiences switching over to teletherapy for all or most of their patients and how that's working out. Susan, actually, both of you work in areas that I assume serve a pretty wide area, maybe rural communities that don't have a lot of options where they are will come to Onalaska or Wausau for help. Susan, let's start with you. Do you see this being something that that people are going to switch to, maybe even, knock on wood, when we're back to normal?
Definitely. I don't think everyone, but I think for some people, that genie's not going back in the bottle. And they're liking it. They're liking the convenience of it. And I think they'll continue that. I think the caveat would be, first of all, will insurance continue to reimburse for that? Is one of the things. And regulations. Those are just the two things that happened really quickly that enabled clinicians and clients to connect online pretty quickly. And you know, that's still unfolding where that's all going to go.
Interesting. And Rachel, I know in Wausau, you're probably a hub for a pretty wide area of people coming to seek help. Do you see some of your clients or maybe other people's clients saying, hey, yeah, I can, you know, I drive an hour and a half, 2 hours. I want to stick with doing this from home.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something there, Rob. And Susan makes some great points in terms of the challenges we face coming up as things change in terms of insurance coverages and state regulations. You know, the relationship people establish with the therapist is really important and worth, the continuity of that relationship is really worth fighting for in terms of keeping that relationship sacred. So I think it's important to advocate for yourself with your insurance companies. And if you, you know, if you talk with them and say, this is really important to me to keep seeing this therapist, we're doing good work and the relationship is important. However, the platform, you know, I think we're going to continue to be able to do this kind of work.
I want to talk about some of the pros and cons here. And I've read in national reporting therapists saying, upside, we get to see people in their own homes, in their own comfort zone. Downside, they're in their own homes with the other people who live in their homes around them. Makes it hard to have a private, confidential conversation. What have you seen, first of all, Susan, when it comes to ups and downsides doing this remotely?
Yeah, I see that primarily mothers with little ones or couples with little ones, it's harder to get away. And so a lot of sessions where a couple is cozy against their headboard with maybe a video in the other room for their kids and hoping that they won't have any interruptions. And another thing, just because of the timing as everything unfolded, was the colleges closed down around the same time. So there were some empty nesters that were maybe meeting as couples or individuals that had all the privacy in the world, and then all of a sudden they've got young adults living with them again. So the privacy, I've had a lot of sessions that I'm guessing Rachel has too, where their clients in their car, and that's the most private place they can get.
Yeah, Rachel, what kind of opportunities and maybe obstacles have you run into?
Susan, you're 100% correct. I've seen more people's vehicles maybe than I've seen in their homes, because that is a place where people can get away, particularly for my teenagers and young adults. They don't want to be in the house where mom or dad can hear what they're talking about with their therapist, and that's great that they can get away and have that private time with me. I think the pros go back to what we had talked about earlier, which was convenience, as well as financially. Gas money, making sure vehicles are in good repair. None of that then has to be a financial burden or issue for my client. They can get their phone, get their Zoom app up on their phone, and they can do therapy. So that's and scheduling as well. So there isn't an issue around trying to find childcare or trying to find those types of things to arrange, because there's the convenience factor of doing the online therapy.
Susan, I'll ask both of you this, and of course you can't talk about individual cases of patients, but in general, this is a tough time. We've got this pandemic. People are worried about their health. They may be worried about or actually dealing with job loss or job cutbacks. Do you sense a greater need for the kind of services that are out there, given just this added level of stress that's out there?
Oh, yes. I think anxiety thrives on uncertainty, and that's all we have around us right now is uncertainty. You talk about jobs. There was a client without any identifying information that had to stop and pause therapy because not only my client, but another family member both lost their job within the same day. And so that affects the finances. It affects everything. So, yes, the anxiety thrives on uncertainty, and everyone's doing their best they can to manage that right now.
And Susan, as Rachel, actually, as we wrap up, can you talk about, maybe the need for people to reach out and seek help where they might not have before in this tough time?
I think now more than ever, we need each other. As humans, we are in an unprecedented time. We cannot ask a living person what it's like to go through a pandemic. They're not here. So we have to rely on each other. We have to talk about these things. We need to experience this together and be as open and vulnerable as we possibly can about what's actually going on for us. No one is alone in this thing that's happening, and there's no right or wrong answer. So I would encourage anyone that's listening, please reach out. We as professionals are absolutely here for you, and we'll try to meet your needs in whatever platform is easiest for you to access.
We'll leave it there. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. This is so important. Thanks for doing this.
And Susan, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Rachel Zentner is a licensed professional counselor at Behavioral Health Clinic in Wausau, and Susan McDonald Conroy is a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist at Clarity Therapy Center in Onalaska. They joined us last month to talk about teletherapy during the pandemic. Coming up, WPR is partnering with StoryCorps for a Military Voices initiative. We'll get the details, including how you can participate. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, politicians around the state and the country are responding to events in Kenosha yesterday when police shot a man leading to protests in the city. We'll get the latest news. First, you may have heard this announcement on Wisconsin Public Radio over the past few weeks.
Hi, I'm WPR's Dom Johnson. I also serve in the Wisconsin National Guard and previously served in the Army Reserves. And I'm excited to tell you about WPR's partnership with StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative. StoryCorps is remotely recording Wisconsin veteran stories August 24th through September 4th. To tell your story, sign up at WPR.org/presents. The Military Voices Initiative is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
WPR is partnering with StoryCorps to record the voices and stories of current and past members of the military here in Wisconsin. Hazel Diaz manages StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative. Hazel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.
Well, we've talked to people from StoryCorps a lot over the years here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Remind us how these StoryCorps interviews work. It's kind of a special thing.
Yeah, so the difference between a typical interview and a StoryCorps interview is that we actually do it with two people that usually know each other and care about each other. And we bring them into a recording space, typically in person, for 40 minutes. And so we're actually doing that virtually now to make sure that everyone's safe as a response to COVID. But you have 40 minutes and you are able to discuss anything that you would like with your partner. So if you and I went in, Rob, and you wanted to have a conversation with me about my time in service, I served in the Marine Corps, and we kind of talked about boot camp and my life experiences and the things that have shaped me. StoryCorps would then take that 40-minute segment, that 40-minute interview, and send it to the Library of Congress to be archived. So it's great because, one, you dictate the narrative of your interview. So we're able to talk about anything that we would like. There is no, it's not a pointed conversation. StoryCorps does not decide what you discuss. And the other thing that's really nice is now that people, you know, feel so disconnected with COVID and having to socially distance, we can go into a space and talk to each other for 40 minutes uninterrupted. And this time is then saved for future generations. So our conversation, Rob, will be archived. And in 100 years, somebody connected to us could look it up and listen to the interview in its entirety without any edits or modifications. So it's really a special project.
And I know among the StoryCorps stories over the years, I've heard some that involved current or active military duty members. Where did the idea for this specific Military Voices Initiative come from?
So we have a number of projects at StoryCorps, including projects that are centered around a certain population. And of course, veterans are and service members are an important population because part of our mission is to preserve and build better connections between people and preserve stories. And the military and their, you know, loved ones and our veterans have stories that are part of the fabric of our country. So we wanted to make sure to include those stories in that population in our, you know, building those connections and a better understanding between people. I think that the time that you serve in the military, you know, 1% of the population actually serves in our military. So it's quite small, even though we all have somebody that we love that has served. And it's important to really give them the platform and amplify their stories and to give them a chance to share things that maybe we haven't had the time to ask them or we haven't given them the time to share. So I'm really grateful for this project and I'm really blessed to manage it.
Talking to Hazel Diaz with StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative. I want to give a listen to one of the stories to get a taste of the kind of thing we're talking about. This is going to be Sergeant Major Lisa Torello. She's talking about her father, who was killed during the Vietnam War. She's talking here with Tony Sestaro, the only survivor of that attack. Let's give a listen.
I know I was the last person your dad saw, and I still see that smile on your father's face. One hand on the steering wheel, and that's how I remember your dad.
When we met yesterday, you said you have your dad's smile.
Yeah.
That just, I lost it. My dad and I had this connection that was deeper than I even understood. And within 2 months after graduating from high school, I left for basic training. And then once I joined the Army, all I really wanted to do was to be his rank. So when I made my father's rank, as soon as the ceremony was over, I went to the bathroom and cried. And I was like, I did it. That was the most monumental thing that ever happened to me. I mean, I wanted to be exactly like him. And 31 years in the Army, I guess I am just like him.
Yeah.
Hazel, can you talk about just the kind of powerful stories you hear along the way as you collect these stories from people?
I think that people really don't realize, one, what a small world it is, and two, how we never really make time to ask people that we love that are around us the important questions. And I think that that's the beauty of StoryCorps, is really being in a space where you are sitting down and you are, you know, thoughtful about the conversation that you're having, and you ask people about things that you've really never put the time aside to discuss, between vets and current GIs and even their families. You know, we've had interviews with spouses that have never really told their significant others what it's like when they go away and how life is so different when they're not around and the difficulties that they face being young and newly married and moving, you know, every couple years and what that's like. Because they just, you know, with life and the kids and everything that's happening, they just haven't really made the time to sit down and really talk to each other about their experience, even if they see it firsthand, or even to tell people how they feel about them and the influence that they've had. We kind of assume that the people that we love know how important they are to us. But it's really a special and magical thing to be able to sit them down and tell them that. And I think that that's something that never gets old, working with StoryCorps, to really meet people that, you know, love each other and have known each other for a long time and really never have stopped to say, you know, I did this because of you, or that was a really hard time for me and you were there for me. Or even, you know, from Afghanistan, I still felt like that was the closest time, you know, we were together, because I really felt like we had each other's backs and we were really supporting each other in a way that we never did before that. I think it's really incredible to be able to do that.
As you mentioned, you usually do these in person. You're doing a virtual tour now, and you are currently in Wisconsin virtually. As I understand it, starting today through September 4th. Do you still have some room for people who want to contribute more stories?
Yes. Today is our first day of recording in Wisconsin. We are so lucky to be there. I definitely shed a tear for not being able to come to Wisconsin in person, because I love it. I love Wisconsin. It is a gorgeous state, and we were pretty disappointed. I think everyone is at this time, but it is so nice to be able to virtually record with people. We do have interviews left. You can go on StoryCorps.org/Military Voices Initiative or MVI, and it will take you right to our page where you can sign up to do the interviews. We have a little less than a dozen left, but if they fill up, there is also a place for a wait list where you can sign up if you are tech savvy, and it won't take much to get you on to our virtual platform. We can sign you up, but that kind of depends on the timeline. But we do have spots still available, and we hope that, you know, we really utilize these spaces and that we can record with our Wisconsin veterans.
In just our last minute, sometimes we don't like to talk about ourselves here in the Midwest. Hazel, make a pitch for people to speak up if they have that story they want to share with each other.
I will say, you don't necessarily have to go into the space thinking about your time in service so much sharing about yourself as to share. It's more to share with someone that you love. So think about sharing this space and this experience with someone. So if you don't even want to share the recording with the Library of Congress or the station, you can just keep it for yourself. You actually don't have to share it with anybody else. You can just keep it for yourself and your family. That's an option at no fee. There's no pressure. But I will say, the people that are most nervous about coming in, the people that always say, oh, you know, I don't have a story, or I'm very boring, or, you know, my time wasn't actionable, they always have the best stories, because they talk about themselves so little that the people around them don't really know about their experiences, that it's really awesome.
Hazel, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for your time, Rob.
Hazel Diaz has managed StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative for 3 years. As we heard there, they are virtually stopping in Wisconsin starting today. They still have some slots left open. To learn more about the project here in Wisconsin and to find out how you and maybe a loved one can participate, you can go to WPR.org/presents. That's WPR.org/presents, spelled like, you know, presents, and find out how to sign up to record your StoryCorps interview. You can also head over to StoryCorps.org for a number of the stories they've collected over the years. They don't just end up in the Library of Congress. They share a lot of them online. A lot of great stories. Be ready to laugh. Maybe have some tissues handy. There are some very touching stories as well. You can find those all at StoryCorps.org. That sound may be familiar. It's the distinctive sounds of a roadrunner being pursued by a coyote who's using a jet-propelled unicycle. That jet-propelled unicycle is one of many fine products from the versatile Acme Corporation. If you, like me, were one of the many generations that grew up with Looney Tunes cartoons, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, the Roadrunner, and the rest, you saw many Acme products in action, usually, but not always, in the hands of Wile E. Coyote. And you may have wondered, is he getting that stuff from out of a catalog? Well, I just found today an industrious fan has been building over the years an online catalog of Acme products, trying to find all of their appearances in the cartoons. At a very old-school-looking website, acme.com/catalog, they've shared images of every Acme design they could find, from mundane products like an Acme anvil or the Acme sugar cube to more high-tech gadgets like the Acme disintegrating pistol and the Acme earthquake pill. But what's with that name, Acme? One rumor was that it was an acronym for a company making everything, or something like that. That appears not to be true. The real deal, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, a lot of small businesses named themselves Acme. One, because it means the best, and two, because it puts you at the top of alphabetical listings in newfangled phone books. It became so common that it started to be used as a generic company name. The rest is cartoon history. There's also that Acme Packing Company in Wisconsin. Whatever happened with that? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.